polarizing images of black clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Good evening and thanks for joining us today. Today on the show, we bring you another edition of Groundwire, grassroots news from campus and community radio across the nation. This is a special G20 edition of Groundwire with plenty of coverage from the streets following the largest mass arrests in Canadian history. But before we get to Groundwire today, we have our weekly Tai'i feature, this week with Robin Smith. In this ongoing collaboration, Robin joins us over the phone to chat about some of the recent stories published on the Tai'i.ca, the independent daily online magazine. And lastly, we're proud to have on this week's edition, on this Monday edition of News 101, the Arts Report from Arts Director Adam Janusz, filling us in on his upcoming program and bringing us some arts coverage from last week's show. That's all on this newscast right here on News 101, your source for community and campus news. We're broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia in a sunny Vancouver. And first, here are your headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Nell Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Israel says today that more cargo trucks will be allowed to enter Gaza and also released a list of goods that will not be allowed in. Cement, steel, and some other raw building materials will now be permitted, but only for Palestinian Authority projects or those undertaken by international entities. Also in Gaza today, Israeli naval vessels opened fire on fishermen, FSRN's Rami Almagari reports.
The decision to relax entry restrictions excludes the Gaza Sea, and Israeli naval forces continue to prevent fishing deep off Gaza shores. Today, medical sources say a fisherman was wounded on board his boat of Gaza City. Also, Israeli vessels opened fire on fishermen on board boats off the southern shores of Rafah and Khan Yunis cities. No injuries were reported. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza reports that at least two fishermen have been injured by Israeli naval vessels since the beginning of 2010. The Gaza-based Agriculture Ministry says that 400 fishing boats are no longer functioning. In June 2007, Israel imposed a comprehensive blockade on Gaza, including its 40-kilometer coastline, making it difficult for Palestinian fishermen to ply their trade. Israel restricted fishing areas that had extended 12 nautical miles offshore before the blockade were reduced to just 2 to 3 nautical miles from land. Rami Almagari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
The capital of the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region in Urumqi was quiet today on the anniversary of last year's unrest. 197 people died, some 1,700 were injured. When the violence between Uyghur and Han Chinese subsided, authorities detained hundreds of mostly Uyghurs and sentenced 25 people to death. In advance of today's anniversary, Chinese authorities installed about 40,000 high-definition cameras in public areas around the capital. China has also implemented a number of social programs to address the underlying causes of tension between the Uyghurs and the Han Chinese, including unemployment. Across India today, a general strike was observed over escalating fuel costs. Jasvinder Sagal has more.
Today's dawn to dusk nationwide strike grounded air travel, disrupted trains and parked buses and trucks. Shops and schools closed in many parts of the country. The protest was called after the Indian government ended curbs on petroleum pricing and hiked the prices of diesel, kerosene and cooking gas. Brinda Karat, spokesperson of the Communist Party, says that the agitation is not intended to gain political mileage, but rather to call attention to the plight of the common citizen.
Price hike of all petroleum products, kerosene, to do with this or that political party. This is against the government policies which affect all sections of the people, particularly the poor.
Police detained nearly 10,000 demonstrators in the state of Maharashtra, where hundreds of buses were damaged. Many opposition leaders courted arrest in support of the shutdown. The Associated Chambers of Commerce and Industry estimates that the strike cost the country more than $20 million. Jaswinder Sehgal, FSR in India.
Poland's interim president has now officially prevailed in presidential elections. Bronislaw Komorowski defeated Jarosław Kaczynski, the identical twin brother of the nation's late president. Some analysts say President Komorowski's Civic Platform Party will continue to roll back the socially conservative pro-welfare policies of the former president. And clashes continue for the fifth day in Mogadishu, where Somali and African Union troops battling extremist rebel militias have killed dozens and wounded hundreds. Abdul Karim Jamali reports for FSRN.
At least 60 people have been killed and nearly 150 others injured in the crossfire. Most of the victims were civilians. Two beekeepers are among the dead. Hundreds of families have fled their homes. The violence began July 1st after Hizbul Islam ordered the media not to broadcast on the country's Independence Day. But the local media refused to follow the orders. Mortar fire across the city followed and has continued since. Somali President Sharif Sheikh Ahmed said today that the nation is in the hands of Al-Qaeda and extremist groups. The African Union has ordered another 2,000 peacekeepers to the region. Abdul Karim Jamale, FSRN.
For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
And thanks to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. We're now going to turn to our weekly segment with the Tai, and on the line we have Robin Smith. Robin, how's it going?
Good, thanks, Andrew. Nice to be here.
Well, I want to first start out by asking you about this article that was recently published on the Tai.ca titled BC's Own Fake Lake Scandal by Tony Pierce. What was discussed in this article?
Well, this is an opinion piece by Tony Pierce, as you said, who's a resource planner specializing in land use and resource management issues involving First Nation communities in Western Canada. And he's got a stake in what we're calling BC's own fake lake scandal. And there's this amazing lake up in northern BC known as Fish Lake, and it's a really gorgeous ecosystem for rainbow trout. I've only seen pictures, and there's one on our site that you can see, but so there's this proposed gold copper mine currently in development in the area. And what the mining company, Taseko Mines Limited, is proposing to do is fill Fish Lake with waste rock from the mine, turning it into a dumping pond and then to construct an artificial lake to compensate for the real one. So Pierce has sort of written an op-ed for the Tai about the lake in anticipation of the release of the Federal Review Panel's environmental assessment of the project, which was handed over to the federal government last Friday. And the review panel found that there would be significant environmental damage to the area if the project moves forward. So now Ottawa has the summer to decide the fate of the project, and Pierce argues that the mining company's fatal flaw is that it hasn't proven it has the technology to adequately recreate this lake, and that even if it did put together a project, it wouldn't really be that sustainable. So this has been an ongoing issue that we followed at the Tai, and now it's just a waiting game for the federal government to make a decision. But I really think there's an interesting story developing there, and Pierce's input, I think, is worth checking out.
Great. Now I want to ask you a bit about another article on the Tai by Monty Paulson, Affordable Homes is a Co-op in Your Future. Tell me a little bit about this article.
Sure. Well, today we published the first in a series by Monty on the reinvention of co-op housing in Vancouver, which of course offers one of the least affordable housing markets in the world, whether you're an owner or a renter. The average Vancouver household earns about $64,000 a year, and a typical bank will loan that family somewhere in the range of $260,000 towards the purchase of their first home. And if you look at the numbers, I mean, a detached Westside bungalow costs, you know, well into the millions and more than four times what the family can afford, and a detached home on the east side costs about $674,000, which is more than twice what the family can afford. So it kind of seems like even thinking about buying a Vancouver home costs you in the city, and many people are stuck renting, which isn't ideal either. So as part of an exploration of affordable housing alternatives, the Tai invited a panel of co-op housing experts to discuss whether co-op housing could be reinvented for the 21st century. And for those who don't know, a housing co-op co-op is a multi-unit property owned by its residents, but unlike a condominium where owners hold titles to individual units, co-op residents are shareholders in a larger entity that owns the buildings. And there are different models, but there haven't really been many created since Condomania took over in the past decade or so. So Paulson's first piece explores the current state of co-op housing in Vancouver, and there's really a great discussion between the panelists that were invited that Paulson explores. They talked about how people don't understand the community concept of a co-op, and also how current economics and policy hasn't favored the development of co-ops as part of an affordable housing strategy for the city. So you can look for more pieces tomorrow and the rest of the week as more from that discussion emerges on the Tai'i.
Great. Well, we look forward to that. Definitely pertinent to Vancouver residents, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want to ask you to talk briefly about another article. Now, this is an arts and culture article. She's Back, Metropolis Revived.
Yeah, this is one of the best pieces on the Tai'i this week, I think. It's really a thoughtful review of the film Metropolis by Dorothy Wooden, which is a film that came out about 80 years ago. But it's been restored with 25 minutes of recovered footage, and it's playing up at Pacific Cinematheque tonight, and I believe tomorrow is the last day to see it. And Metropolis is a film that's said to have inspired many, from Hitler to Stanley Kubrick to Madonna music videos, and a really awesome hip-hop album by Janelle Monáe, which was my introduction to the film. It's really a film that's been deeply mythologized over the years as well. So Wooden argues that it's really interesting to see the film again. It's ever relevant to our current world of, you know, full of city riots, and explores some of the same ideas and conflicts we see in major metropolises around the world. So Wooden writes every couple of weeks on film for the Tai'i, and I really love her perspective. So I think that'd be a great thing for readers to check out as well.
Great. Well, Robin, thanks so much for joining us on this Monday edition of News 101. And maybe we'll hear from you next week, or maybe we'll hear from somebody else at the Tai'i. But again, thanks so much for joining us, and we look forward to talking to you real soon.
You too, thanks.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye. And that was Robin Smith from the Tai'i.ca. She was joining us for the weekly segment that we have with the Tai'i, bringing us their coverage onto our show from the Tai'i.ca. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And up ahead, we've got your weekly health news and tips from Sharon Hundel and Arts Director Adam Janusz's Arts Report. We also have Spencer Lindsay joining us in studio quite soon to bring us an update about a proposed redevelopment at Fraser and Broadway. That's right here on News 101. Stay tuned.
Big government and big pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to big pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so big pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education. Every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
I'm troubled by shapeless fears. Who can live in the modern world without catching his share of them? I hope I've landed on my feet this time.
Need a place to rent? Have a place for rent? AMS Rents Line can help. AMS Rents Line is an easy-to-operate, touch-tone, and web-based system that connects thousands of landlords with UBC students looking for off-campus housing. UBC students can search the ads for free or place a two-week posting for $5. To view current listings, visit www.amsrentsline.com.
CITR 101.9 FM presents Turbo Fruits with special guests Golden Triangle and Tight Solid at the Biltmore Cabaret on July 5th. Doors are at 8 and the show starts at 9:30. Tickets are $11 in advance at Zulu, Red Cat, Scratch. Tickets are available online at theticketweb.ca. Nashville-based Turbo Fruits with special guests Golden Triangle and Tight Solid at the Biltmore Cabaret, July 5th. For more information, visit CITR.ca.
And you're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And Spencer Lindsay joins us in studio. He's here to talk about a proposed redevelopment at Fraser and Broadway that would bring some social housing units to the east side. And Spencer, can you just give us some context to this?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm a resident of that area, and I first actually found out about this new development because of a flyer that had been going through the neighborhood. And there's a group that's opposed to this development, who are quite organized. You know, they have their own plan for the neighborhood, and this new development would include about 103 units of social housing. It's quite a big development, and it doesn't really fit, you know, with the heritage kind of feel of Mount Pleasant, they think. So
A lot of the concerns that were brought up is that the proposed height, or it's supposed to be 11 stories, is that right?
Yeah. Basically, I mean, if the rezoning goes through, that makes it, you know, go from a commercial to a multi-use zone, so it gives them the right. But there's a lot of stuff up for debate. One is the use, which kind of is, like, a lot of people are opposed to having, you know, social housing because of what the residents, they're afraid of crime and drugs. But there's also a lot to do with the form of the building. There's been talk about cutting it down to 8 stories, which would maybe make it less of a misuse space. They might mixed-use space have less room for market rental as well as social housing. And then there's also talk about designing the building a bit different to give more kind of green space and make it fit better with kind of aesthetics of that area. So
now, you've testified at council at a public hearing, is that correct?
Yeah, okay. This is on tomorrow, July 6th, there's going to be the second reconvening, the third meeting, because there's 52 speakers signed up to talk. So I went and I kind of made the argument that, you know, this isn't about personal politics. You know, there's a lot of people that are angry that, you know, their plan for Mount Pleasant isn't going through because, you know, the province has this money to do this, make this unit, and it's kind of, you know, like, go big or go home. And a lot of people are concerned about that. They want say over what their community looks like. So that's where a lot of the debate is.
Now, also at that location, the Broadway Youth Resource Center has also been at that location for, I believe, since 1999. I may be a couple of years off, but I know they've been there a number of years, and they provide resources for youth and also reach out to Aboriginal youth as well. And there in the proposed project, they would have space in the new development. And for you, this is also something that you feel that would be advantageous for that neighborhood to continue providing people with, and something that really needs to be to stay in that neighborhood.
Yeah, I mean, we're looking at a possibility to turn the Broadway Youth Resource Center into a two-story facility with extra, you know, they're working out of one classroom. They offer, you know, upgraded adult education. They have art space. They have mental health counselors. They have all sorts of resources. And this is a chance to make it really, you know, serve that need that is there. I mean, and the fact that some of these social housing units are going to be dedicated to youth. Some people are concerned about that, but I think that is an amazing idea to have a place for these kids that are already using this resource center to have a stable home right above it. And so this is a big opportunity for Broadway Youth Resource Center. These are the kind of places that are always, you know, getting cut and really, really struggling to keep their space. You look at the Knowledgeable Aboriginal Youth Association, they just lost their space a couple months ago. I mean, this is more than just about a big, you know, social housing unit. There's a lot of potential to really have a lot of benefits for the community.
So there's another public hearing tomorrow, council chambers. What time is that at? 7:30?
It starts at 7:30, and that's on the third floor of the City Hall.
Yeah,
but you can also watch it at vancouver.ca. There's a web stream. So.
Okay, and you'll be testifying again. Is that, or are you done?
I'm done. Okay, but I'm really excited to see what the outcome
okay.
is.
Okay, well, so. Great, Spencer, and I think we'll probably speak to you next week about the outcome of that hearing and just providing us with a little more detail on this issue. So this is a big issue for the Mount Pleasant neighborhood, and we look forward to talking to you soon.
Thanks a lot.
And this is News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. And we're now going to go to the arts report with provided to us by Adam Janusz, the arts director. And here is his arts report for today, Monday, July 5th.
This is the arts report for News 101. I'm Adam Janusz. On last week's show, I had slam poet Jamie DeWolf talking about his recent show at the Rio Theater called Lewd, Crude, and Out of Control. We spent a lot of time talking about his unique blend of poetry, short films, comedy, and other acts. And we also touched a lot on his relation to Scientology founder L. Ron Hubbard. What we didn't have time to broadcast on Wednesday was Jamie talking about his friend and fellow poet Shane Koizan, whom he's known for a very long time. So here's a little bit of that conversation. You know our local hero, Shane Koizan?
Of course, yes.
How long have you known him?
I have known Shane since 1999, 2000. So he has performed at Tourette's Without Regrets. He, I've known him for a while. So he hasn't toured much in the States that much, because I think in the last, like, you know, 5 years or so, he's just become such a juggernaut in Canada that he doesn't really need to, which is totally understandable. But I love the Shane. Shane is phenomenal.
And did you see him in the Olympics in the opening ceremony?
Yes. Someone hit me to it on Facebook. I hate to say it, but I just really don't watch much of the Olympics. The Olympics are so odd. It's like the one time of the year that people actually pretend to care about swimming.
Right. You know? Or
like all these random sports are like, they're like watching devotedly swimming. And I'm like, right. You know, what? Like, it's just amazing what, like, just some, you know, you add a little spark of competition to anything.
Right.
And people make people feel like someone is your ambassador, and people lose their damn minds. Like, get him, America. Like, what? You know, especially America, because they're just such a mercenary country. You know, it doesn't even matter if, like, you know, you can be from any other country and just move to America, and then you're on the American team, you know, and they're like, yeah, you're doing it for me. You know, it really has nothing to do with it. Someone hit me on Facebook, and they're like, holy shit, Shane Koizan is at the Olympics. And I was like, what? You know, and I watched this clip, and it's Shane Koizan, you know, standing on this raised dais with like hundreds of thousands of swarms of people. And yeah, I would imagine it's almost what the Antichrist would look like rising to power. You know, that you know this man from humble beginnings, you know, and you see him read in little cafes. And he's, you know, I mean, I remember when Shane first kind of hit the scene, and he was that good from the get-go. He just was amazing, you know, out of the gate. And he was really prolific, and he had all of his work memorized, and he was just an amazingly clever writer. Like, his writing had such, like, powerful metaphors, and they're really interwoven very well. And he just had this really, really intense kind of musical flow to him. And yeah, right out the gate, he just seized all of Nationals and became like everybody's beloved hero, as he was so damn badass, you know. And obviously, I mean, his like how he looks physically was like this huge aspect of it. It was like, you know, you see this guy comes up who, you know, with his glasses and his like fuzzy little beard and a lot of people in the crowd didn't know what to expect. and the energy that he would create, though, when he first started slamming, because he'd walk up and everyone would be like, who is this guy? And then everyone who's seen him before is like, oh shit, oh shit, oh shit, this is the Shane. And they, you know, everyone would just start calling him the Shane. And like,
on this Wednesday's Arts Report, I'll have an interview with Caitlin McCall of the Dancing on the Edge Festival, which will begin on July 8th and will feature almost 2 weeks of dance all over the city, including a rooftop dance party. Here's a bit of that interview.
To begin, tell me about Dancing on the Edge. What is it?
Dancing on the Edge, it's a contemporary dance festival. We are in our 22nd year this year, so it's a pretty nicely established in Vancouver. We present usually between 18 and 20 artists and performances, festival. It's usually 10 days. This season we've actually gone, we got some extra funding to do a community initiative. So we've extended it to 11 days and we are planning a street dance party.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that's happening on Sunday, which is the 18th, so that's the 11th day of the festival, is Karen Jameson Dance is doing this community parade. It's a project that she did with the Carnegie Dance Troupe, so with the Carnegie Center, and they're doing this parade that goes down Main Street from Carnegie, goes to the downtown east side, and ends up on the rooftop of Sunrise Market, and where we're going to have a big dance party.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, there's tons of stuff happening. We do dance classes during the festival.
Yeah.
And there's usually, I think this year, there's somewhere between 3 to 4 performances an evening. Going from about 7 to 10 each night. So,
and what's the purpose? Like, what makes Dancing on the Edge different from any other sort of performing arts festival?
Dancing on the Edge is, I mean, it's an amazing festival because it works with, I mean, it brings dance to the community and it brings dance to Vancouver. And I know that there are, you know, there's other festivals that do the same things, but we focus a lot on making it accessible. We, you know, every year we've done free site performances. We have Dust Dances, which happens in Queen Elizabeth Park. So it's a free, you know, community initiative to get people who may not feel as comfortable walking into a theater and seeing dance. They get to go see something in their local park that's very interactive. That's, you know, you might be walking your dog in the park and you get to go see some contemporary dance.
Don't miss The Arts Report every Wednesday at 5 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM and online at citr.ca. Now back to the news.
And thanks for Adam for that arts report. Now we're going to go to the weather, and in studio, Daniel Casanova. Daniel, what's in store for us this week?
Thanks, Andrew. Well, summer's officially here at last. Look forward to perfect beach conditions throughout the week, as it will be sunny with daytime highs in the mid-20s. Inland high temperatures will be in the high 20s and low 30s as well. All this is thanks to a high-pressure system west of us in the Pacific. For tonight, we will have clear skies with a low of 14. For Tuesday, it will be sunny with a high of 23 degrees and low of 15. On Wednesday, it will be sunny with a high of 28, low of 16 degrees. For Thursday, it will be sunny again with a high of 29 degrees, low of 17. And for Friday, well, you guessed it, sunny with a high of 30, low of 18 degrees. On Saturday, it will be sunny with possible cloudy periods, high of 25, low of 16 degrees. And for Sunday, it will be sunny with possible cloudy periods again, high of 24 degrees, low of 16. Currently, it is 18 degrees and sunny at YVR. That's your weather this week, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. For News 101, I'm Daniel Casanova.
Thanks, Daniel. Sun, sun, sun. I like what I'm hearing. This is great. And we're going to close our show out today. And we've got a special edition of Groundwire with all G20 coverage. So thanks for tuning in. This is News 101. And today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334. Or you can email news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITR News. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Andrew Longhurst from the entire news team at CITR. Thanks for listening. Bronwyn Loden produced this edition of News 101. And up next is the special G20 edition of Groundwire, followed by Career Fast Track. And also say that I will be posting a full interview with anti-HST leader Bill van der Zalm on the CITR website at citr.ca, something that because of the special G20 coverage, we weren't able to provide you with on News 101. So check out our website for a full interview with Bill van der Zalm. This is News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM here in Vancouver. Here is Groundwire.
Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News. I'm Murphy Brown.
And I'm Oriel Varga.
In this edition...
I was in the middle of it all, filming it all. They were requesting me to leave the area, which I wouldn't do.
Pride has always been political. It was born out of a riot, and it's all about politics.
We need gender justice immediately and also justice around disability.
This is the second edition of Groundwire Goes to G20, a reflection on the summit hosted by Canada this week.
But before we get to our G20 features and national news this week.
A Canadian gold company is suing El Salvador for $100 million after a people's movement opposed the company's mining operation.
Canadian mining company Pacific Rim claims that by not awarding the company a permit for its proposed gold mine, El Salvador is in breach of CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement.
Canada, however, is not signatory to CAFTA. Therefore, the Vancouver-based Pacific Rim is filing a suit through its U.S. subsidiary. El Salvadorian activists oppose the Pacific Rim's mining operations in part because they say gold mining operations demand large amounts of fresh water, something El Salvadorians have little access to. Anti-mining activists also say that mining corporations will not adequately distribute their profits to indigenous communities.
On June 28, Enbridge, a Canadian energy company, confirmed its plans for a $400 million expansion in northern Alberta to accommodate rising production from the oil sands. The expansion will enable Enbridge to process an additional 229,000 barrels a day. The company currently processes 350,000 barrels daily.
In Toronto, the yearly Pride Parade went political on July 3rd and 4th as the previously banned groups Queers Against Israeli Apartheid, or QUAIA, did in fact march on both Saturday and Sunday.
QUAIA was banned by Pride Toronto earlier amid complaints from the Canadian Jewish Congress and other groups. QUAIA was invited back to the parade after prominent gays and lesbians came out in support of the group, and the marchers agreed to abide by Toronto's anti-discrimination policy. The controversy also inspired a campaign called My Pride is Political.
What's your name?
Sandra Dugman-Mansour.
And why did you come out today?
Well, I am a Chilean Palestinian. I'm a queer woman of color, and I thought it was important not only to come and say I'm proud to be queer, but also I'm proud to be Palestinian. And
why is your pride political?
It's political for that exact reason. I'm not only marching saying that I'm proud to be queer, but I'm also saying there's other parts of the world where queer people are being persecuted and they don't have the same rights as everyone else.
My name is Sue Goldstein, and I'm with Queers Against Israeli Apartheid and the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network, among others. Pride has always been political. It was born out of a riot, and it's all about politics. We don't leave our different identities at the door of Pride and say, I'm just queer today. I'm also a woman. I'm also a feminist. I'm also an anti-Zionist Jew. And homophobia knows no borders.
This month, the Federation of Canadian Municipalities, FCM, overwhelmingly endorsed a call from the country's mayors to expand the Canadian pension plan. However, not everyone will necessarily benefit from the expanded pension plan.
On June 2nd, Prime Minister Harper put forth Bill C-31. The bill would exclude prisoners aged 65 or older from collecting old age security. The Harper government plans on first issuing cuts to those federally incarcerated for 2 years or more, then extend the cuts to prisoners in provincial institutions serving sentences of more than 90 days.
The decision came after the Canadian Taxpayers Federation sent a petition demanding the government to stop pension entitlements to elderly prisoners using serial killer Clifford Olson's pension as a sensational example. The John Howard Society has called Bill C-31 short-sighted.
The Canadian Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies released a statement addressing women prisoners and those incarcerated from marginalized communities. Quote, "Women are the fastest growing prison population worldwide, especially poor women, Aboriginal women, and women with disabling mental health issues. This dramatic growth of women prisoners can largely be attributed to the retreat of Canada's social safety net and by the evisceration of affordable health care, child care, social assistance, and other community supports and educational opportunities." End of quote.
As Canada Post searches for a new president, labor groups are campaigning against the privatization of public services. The Canadian Union of Postal Workers has taken the extraordinary step of releasing a letter to Canada Post asking them to require the new president be committed to keeping Canada Post public. The Canadian Union of Postal Workers has taken the extraordinary step of releasing a letter to Canada Post asking them to require the new president be committed to keeping Canada Post public. CUPW's Denis Lamelin.
For us, it's really important that when we look at the CEO of Canada Post, that we put forward our view. And for us, it's to maintain the universal and public postal service. And we know that 70% of the population of the country want to keep it public because they know it's a large country.
Outgoing Canada Post President Moya Green, who headed the privatization of CN Rail, said recently, quote, "There is a view that I know our union has, that they believe government ownership is the only way to ensure Canadians will get great service. Perhaps this is not rigidly the case." End of quote.
Green heads to England to oversee the privatization of Britain's Royal Mail.
No idea is original, the plan is many centuries old. The only difference is the way it was sold. What you put your brain power on, material glamour and large paper. Global elites coming to rape you. No idea is original, the plan is many centuries old. Only difference is the way it was sold. What you put your brain power on, material glamour and large paper. Global elites coming to rape you. I'm in a G20 police state, but in a peace state of mind. Wait, bump that, cause I'm...
Welcome to Groundwire Community News. The music you just heard was the G20 dub by Toronto artist Progress. Now to Groundwire's analysis of last week's G20 summit.
Though held in Toronto, the G20 inspired action around the country. In Vancouver on June 26, crowds gathered at the East Hastings Street, and in Montreal on Canada Day, 1,000 supporters rallied to decry the mass detentions that took place in Toronto. According to Toronto police, nearly 900 people were arrested. The Canadian Civil Liberties Association and other citizen groups are calling for a public inquiry into the conditions of mass detention.
David Parker has this account from the Alternative Media Center.
Many are saying Toronto descended into a police state during a week of protests against the visiting G8 and G20 in Canada. Reports continue to emerge as people are being released from police custody. During the week of June 21st to 28, around 900 people were detained by police, the largest mass arrests in Canadian history. Many of the 900 arrested were beaten or threatened by police, and some suffered punches, kicks, strangleholds, baton beatings, the use of pepper spray, tear gas, and rubber bullets, while others walking down the street were snatched up by police driving in unmarked vans. Dan Hamilton was segregated in a cell for gays and lesbians, quote, for their own protection, end quote, according to the police.
I was inside for about 26 hours, I guess. At the 24th hour, I demanded that I to be released because that was my rights, and they assured me that my rights didn't apply in that building. Just kept going on. He's like, actually, I'm gonna put you and your boyfriend in a segregated room. And it was just a little stall, like it looked like a dog pen, and there was a whole line of just gay people in these like one person things. There was like a lesbian couple, there was me and my boyfriend, and then there was two separate lesbians that were just put there just because they were gay, but they were put there for their own safety. Like, the entire group was not homophobic whatsoever. The only people who were homophobic in that building were the police. Like,
members of civil society are currently calling for an independent inquiry into police conduct during the G20 arrests. For Groundwire, I'm David Parker in Halifax.
The conditions of the detentions may have come as a surprise to many Canadians. However, arbitrary detention is a common experience for many Canadians who identify with marginalized groups, such as racialized communities, those with disabilities, the homeless, and non-status workers. The G20 is a wake-up call to address these ongoing violations. Here are voices collected from the marches, detentions, and arrests.
The people trying to organize the events get put in jail, then maybe the events don't happen. But what the police don't know is that's not how organizing works. When we care about something, we all come out, especially when people we know have been detained. So I'd like you to all welcome Sharmeen Khan from the Toronto Community Mobilization Network. What happened on Saturday is not unique, but what we saw this past weekend with preemptive arrests, arbitrary violence, police violence, threats of sexualized violence, this is a reality for Indigenous, migrant, and poor communities all over the country.
My name's Amy Miller. We were on our way to cover the jail solidarity action. I was throttled at the neck and held down, and then I was detained for nearly 13 hours. I was placed in a cell at the Toronto Film Studio, and I was in a cell with 25 other young women for approximately 13 hours. Throughout the time that I was detained, I was told many statements that I find repulsive and completely inappropriate, and what I view as threats. I was told I was going to be raped. I was told I was going to be gangbanged. I was told that they were going to make sure that I was never going to want to act as a journalist again.
Racialized Aboriginal communities, undocumented communities have always faced these types of persecutions. And that what has occurred, I guess, is a public show and a public show of a police state, something that's been invisible to most of most people. And I think that what we are now seeing is how, when in the downtown core of Toronto, when the public spaces are violated, we're seeing a fight back. And I think that's extremely critical. But I don't think it's over. I think some people may just think it's an exception that is simply around G20. But I think we're going to continue to see the exertion of these police powers.
I'm here because as a trans person, I think that we need gender justice immediately and also justice around disability. I mean, a lot of us have been, you know, continually targeted by the police. So seeing such a show of force by police is actually terrifying. It's re-traumatizing and it's not helping the situation. As a racialized person, I'm black and I, you know, it's always concerning. They're more likely to stop, you know, people of color, and certainly as a trans person, a person with a disability, that we're the ones who are heavily targeted. So this is terrifying.
Those who want to hold police accountable for any assaults they experienced may have a hard time because of the Interprovincial Policing Act in Ontario.
This piece of legislation passed in 2009 means legal proceedings against out-of-province officers must be brought to the province from which the officer originates, creating an onerous burden on complainants. The Act speeds up the permission process to bring out-of-province officers and gives police powers outside of their jurisdiction.
The elite's most anticipated design is here. One planet aligned in fear. From Czechoslovakia, Botswana to Latvia, Argentina, Korea, India, back to Austria. Big brother's been watching us, more like stalking us.
Despite its previous commitments to aid to Africa, academics say this year's G20 summit largely ignored the continent and furthered an economic agenda that excludes African nations from decision-making while promoting resource extraction from Africa. Ome Salma Rahantula has this report.
As the G20 met in Toronto last week, Africans around the city, and indeed around the world, were voicing their concerns with these global groupings and their devastating effects on the African continent. From concerns ranging from environmental degradation to economic injustice, the forces of globalization are not benefiting the poor, especially in the global south. The G20 includes only one African nation, South Africa. What are the implications for the African continent with South Africa as its representative? How are policies implemented by the G8 and G20 countries, such as NAPAD or GEAR, serving to funnel resources, both material and economic, out of African countries? Aziz Fall is the co-founder of GRILLA, the Group for Research and Initiative for the Liberation of Africa. He addresses how post-apartheid South Africa abandoned the RDP, a homegrown economic initiative.
The great hope on the RDP, which was the development strategy that the ANC and the Freedom Charter, you know, expected. This was abandoned in favor of the GER, which is an economic program drafted along the line of structural adjustment policy of the IMF and the other Bretton Woods institutions, but on South African own initiative, not even from the Bretton Woods, just to be integrated in the world capital system. So we obtained a political victory, but in fact, it was an economic blackmail.
The actions of G20 countries are clearly not benefiting the poor, especially those in Africa, even though South Africa is a member of the G20 and Meles Zenawi, leader of Ethiopia, was invited to the summit. Abdi Darshi is the current president of the Somali-Canadian Diasporic Alliance and explains how Zenawi is a puppet of American and European interests in the continual exploitation of the African continent.
Very clear that people who carry out the policies of the Western, new imperialism, the colonization project in Africa, are extended such an invitation. Meles Zenawi has been an ally that they could count on the war of terror in Somalia, the so-called war on terror. He has been a reliable friend to carry out projects that the Western nations view as very important, like the issues in Darfur. Ethiopia has some troops over there, so this is why he has been invited. He's an ally of the Western nations in Africa. See, in my own country, in Somalia, Somalia is very strategic location. It's the gateway to the Middle East and the Red Sea. It has a wealth of gas and natural resources that still need to be carried out. So Africa basically is very important to the expansion of capital and expansion of wealth for the Western countries.
Isaiah Kipinyong is the program officer for policy and advocacy at the Norwegian Church Aid in Nairobi, Kenya, and advocates for the responsibility of rich countries in global warming and its effect on the African continent.
I'm really talking about climate change, knowing that it has been caused by emissions of fossil fuels by rich countries like Canada, and the impacts are felt most in poor countries like my country, Kenya. And so I am here to just raise my voice to say that these injustices must stop, and the G8 that are meeting here and the G20 have to do something about it. They have to stop ignoring the voices of people. Corporates and governments have not shown leadership. Climate change is urgent and it is an emergency.
Reporting from the People's Resistance to the G20 Summit in Toronto, this is Ome Salma Rahimtullah for Groundwire.
They barely garnered mention in most media, but bilateral agreements were the most tangible product of the G20 Summit. Journalist Stefan Christoph was interviewed recently by Red Eye Radio and explains the new era of bilateral diplomacy, as well as some of the most influential deals made that you haven't heard of.
Literally, there is a tapestry of agreements across the world, and Canada is playing a quite active role in pursuing these bilateral negotiations. A lot of the push towards bilateral country-to-country agreements or even regional trade accords came after the collapse of the World Trade Organization, the WTO's international ministerial meetings in Cancun, Mexico. And since that time, we've really seen a push, particularly from major economic players in the world, in the Western countries, really, in Canada, the United States, Western Europe, to secure bilateral agreements. So, for example, Canada at this moment is negotiating agreements across the world, whether it's the controversial accord with Colombia that has gotten some play, to more obscure agreements with countries like Bahrain in the Middle East, or Morocco, which are currently pending. But in all these other agreements, you're having a demand within trade legislation to normalize relations with Israel. The central theme is that, unlike the World Trade Organization, where, you know, with all the critiques that one could have towards that institution, the fact is that in the bilateral context, there is a much more unequal relationship. It's really quite striking. If you line up the 20 countries that Canada has quote-unquote chosen for its aid focus, those are the same countries that Canada is currently focusing on securing bilateral agreements with.
Yeah. You already know progress. We know the revolution won't be televised unless we do the filming. We welcome these clowns to our city. Once again, our city. So when we resist, we understand who runs this shit. They fear us. We don't fear them. You see that earthquake today? That wasn't no earthquake. That was us mobilizing. That was us forming. You see it?
Also absent from the G20 discussions was treaty rights for Indigenous peoples.
First Nations demonstrators marched for several community issues, including violence against First Nations women and territorial sovereignty.
On June 24th, thousands of Indigenous people took to the streets of Toronto to make their voices heard and march for Indigenous sovereignty.
I'm delivering a message on behalf of Ontario Regional Chief Angus Toulouse, on behalf of all the chiefs of Ontario. This week, the chiefs have been meeting up in the Fort Francis area, so a lot of the leadership is up there dealing with a number of issues affecting our First Nations. So I'll read his statement. It's a brief statement. First Nations in Ontario call on Canada and world leaders to act on First Nations rights. Canada, along with the United States, are the lone holdouts in signing on to the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Canada claims on the Indian and Northern Affairs Canada website that Canada's record on the rights of Indigenous people speaks for itself. We agree, but in our view, the record establishes that Indigenous poverty, poor health, lack of infrastructure, housing, clean water, displacement from the wealth of the land, and the resources is a direct result of Canada's laws and policies in the past and today. In October of 2007, the UN Special Rapporteur on Housing released a report which stated, "I was disturbed to see the devastating impact of the paternalism that marks federal, provincial government, legislations, policies, and budgetary allocations for Aboriginal people, both on and off reserve. Expect better from the Canadian government and the international community. We expect to crown the honor of the treaties that we signed together on a nation-to-nation basis. We call on the international community to pressure Canada to uphold the obligation in international treaties and covenants that it signed on to and to recognize the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples." On behalf of the 40 communities I represent in the Anishinaabeg Nation, I bring you greetings. We are saying to the Canadian government they need to continue to work with us on a nation-to-nation basis. We have many outstanding land claims. We have unfulfilled treaty obligations.
No G20, a stolen native land. No G20, a stolen native land. No G20, a stolen native land. No.
I'm talking with Doreen Silversmith.
I did the whole march from Queen's Park and through the streets and over to Allen Gardens here. It's ridiculous, the billions that they spent on the security and that, and to put up those fences and that to protect 20 leaders, you know. And so that's ridiculous. That could have been spent on homelessness. There are people living on the streets, a lot of us have our rights violated every day, every single day. So, you know, that could have been spent on that, or more resources could have been put towards bringing the perpetrators to trial of the missing and murdered Ongwahoma women across this land. Now the Native Women's Association of Canada says that there's 580 missing, but I believe there's more than that, because I did some traveling last summer to some Native communities, and that was only a few Native communities, and everywhere I went, there was missing or murdered women in those communities. You know, and there's no outrage from ordinary Canadians about that either, you know. In Canada, so-called Canada, we call it Turtle Island, Canada rates among the top 10 in the world, right, as the best countries to live in. But if you go, if you going to take into consideration the living conditions, which are appalling, on they call it reserves, we call it territories, because it's our land, and it goes, that number reaches 63, and there are also six times the national average of our young people committing suicide. Canada is such a great place to live, then why is this happening, you know?
No, G20, a stolen native land! No, G20, a stolen native land! No, G20!
Putting the G20 on notice that we reject what they are up to in terms of trying to consolidate, you know, the power and the wealth at a global level. Everything is done by greed and for profit, where the land isn't looked at as our Mother Earth, but looked at as a resource base. Indigenous people do not look at it from that perspective. We know that whatever we do as Indigenous people to the planet will sooner or later impact on us as human beings.
You've been listening to Chief Patrick Mudavi, Arthur Emmanuel, and Doreen Silversmith, all marching for Indigenous sovereignty this past June 24th on the streets of Toronto. For CKLN, I'm Susie Alvarez.
A tough act to follow, but we represent the 4 million people of Toronto. We represent the 6 billion people on the globe. And we can all decide to collectively say no to the end of the yen, the dollar and peso. Cause when one world currency comes, it's case closed. They can make guns, but they can't create soul. Resist through this real hip hop and rock and roll. Resist through these clenched up.
Welcome back to Groundwire Community Radio News. Groundwire is aired on 30 community radio stations across Canada. Download all episodes at groundwire.ncra.ca.
And now it's time for the Community Radio Report. This week from the Alternative Media Center at the G20, CFRC's Christiana Clemens chronicled what happened to the independent journalists looking to document the meetings and protests.
It's a rainy Saturday in Toronto as activists gather for a 25,000-strong march to voice their discontent with the G20 summit taking place here. Alternative media journalists have also taken to the streets to document voices of dissent that have been shut out of the official summit. Alternative media has a different story to tell, one that celebrates grassroots struggles rather than ostentatious displays of power and wealth. But in an alarming trend, alternative journalists working at this summit have found themselves targeted and attacked by police. Videographer Brian Jordan was kicked and beaten while filming this afternoon in Toronto's Queen's Park.
My name is Brandon Jordan. I'm a freelance journalist. I work regularly with Democracy Now! I'm here on assignment for Grit TV, and I'm also working and contributing to Democracy Now! I got to Queen's Park between 6:30 and 7, where people were kind of standing, and it seemed like they were already mildly traumatized. And almost in just a few minutes in, the police started rushing into the crowd, grabbing people at random, pulling them and arresting them, beating several of them somewhat severely. I was documenting the footage, and after documenting a couple people being grabbed in one shot, the police ran in, knocked me to the ground, started kneeing me, hitting me with batons, and I kept my camera rolling. They kept telling me, get up. I wasn't really able to get up because they kept kicking me down. Getting back here to the Alternative Media Center, what I found difficult was, because so many people were beaten, so many people were harmed, that it was really difficult to determine what was the news for the day.
And you had your press credentials on while this incident happened with the police this afternoon?
I was wearing press credentials, I was shooting with a professional camera, and I was doing my very best to kind of stay out of the way and document what was happening.
A participant with Toronto's media co-op saw police targeting other journalists with rubber bullets.
Hey, I'm Kevin. I've been doing photo work the last couple days. I've been doing some writing as well with the Toronto media co-op. What I've seen of harassment of journalists so far, in general, there's just like a lot of not letting press into spaces. Personally, they've just said scary things to me as I've been doing stuff. They told me they remembered me from yesterday, today. Then it really sort of took off at one moment when they just started attacking journalists. Because a lot of the people at the front were journalists trying to get shots of the cops themselves. I know definitely I saw them shoot at a journalist in the leg. with a rubber bullet.
And Jesse Freestone from the Real News Network was punched in the face by a riot cop.
I was in the middle of it all, filming it all. They were requesting me to leave the area, which I wouldn't do, given that this abuse is going on, at which point they started to hit my camera out of the way. I still wouldn't leave, and that's when they started to throw me backwards. And then one officer named Martinez punched me in the face twice. Then I tried to interview him to find out, you know, where he got that protocol from, or what, you know, what was, were they under orders to punch journalists? At which point he stole my microphone, which is a wireless lavalier mic. You know, I requested it back, and a lot of people joined me. Some other journalists joined me, along with some other marchers joined me, to yell at the police to give me my mic back.
As of midnight on Saturday, three journalists had been arrested and jailed. All were involved with Toronto's Alternative Media Centre, established to provide independent coverage of the G20 summit and related events. From CFRC-FM, this is Christiana Clemens.
That is it for Grand Wire Goes to the G20.
We've been your hosts. This is Oriel Varga.
And Murphy Brown.
This edition produced at CKL in Toronto with thanks to Susie Alvarez. Music by Progress. We also thank headline contributors Frida Worden, Joel Bard, and Annabelle Koo.
Groundwire is a national grassroots news program. To sponsor an edition, email groundwirepitch@ncra.ca. For their support, Groundwire thanks the Public Service Alliance of Canada, performing quality public service on behalf of Canadians. To learn more, visit www.psac.com.